WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. We've lost many great rock performers to car accidents and plane crashes on the way to and from concerts. Friday night, we lost the world's most important rock impresario. Bill Graham died in a helicopter crash on the way home from a concert by Huey Lewis, which he had promoted. Graham was 60 years old. We remember him now with a 1989 interview I recorded with him in San Francisco. It was there that he first made his mark as the rock promoter of the psychedelic scene. He came up with the idea of turning old theaters into rock venues. He had the Fillmore in San Francisco and the Fillmore East in New York. He eventually branched out into every aspect of rock promotion and was a producer of several groundbreaking international benefits like Live Aid and the Amnesty International concert tours. In the 60s, when Bill Graham got into the rock business, lots of the people who went to his concerts thought of business as a dirty word.
Music was chosen by the mass to be free because to a great extent it was free in the park on the weekends, and it was very difficult to tell the public also that many of the shows that were staged on the weekends, we provided the sound and the lights from the profits that we earned from the Fillmore. But the word business, or any connotation of business, or the law, the cops, the pigs, the fuzz, was a negative aspect of our society.
Well, how did you deal with that as a businessman? Did you feel like you had to defend yourself and defend making a profit?
It was by far the most difficult time of my life. The most joyous, because it was all new and it was fresh, and there were no blueprints in how to run these kinds of concerts and how to deal with the public. The difficulty was in having the patrons look at me as perhaps the enemy, or if it wasn't for people like you, music would be free, and trying to explain to them that in order for music to be free, all the other elements that go into the concert must be free. Trucking must be free, electricity, telephones, transportation, getting the artists to the facility, and all the people that work here would have to have other means of income. But we all need to deal with the reality of life. Dealing with that reality at that time, with the power to the people syndrome, was at times very debilitating, and being the point man was very unpleasant.
Did you get into philosophical debates with audiences and with rock musicians about
every
how much
day.
Profit was the appropriate amount of profit
every
to take?
Day? There wasn't a day that went by. Why is the ticket price that high? Why isn't it free, or the whole spare change, and why can't I get in free when I don't have the funds? But I would always challenge anybody's forceful attempt to enter a facility because they felt it was their right that this should be free. Because invariably I'd say, what does your father do? And if he was a plumber or a baker, I said, well, I'd like to get my plumbing fixed for free. I'd like some bread for free, and tell me your father's address. And that hit a stone wall. But it took years to get over the past that.
Was there a difference between the way you were running your operation and the way people from the counterculture who were producing concerts were running it?
Well, there were other people who were very sincere in their approach also. One of the things that I tried to do is to bring in music that they didn't ask for, but music that I know was important and became very important to me. If it was Latin or jazz or R&B, and knowing that The Airplane or The Dead or Quicksilver would sell all the tickets, I wouldn't have to worry about draw. Mm-hmm. So I was able to go to Chuck Berry or the Staples Singers, as I said. And yet these artists had become, the film became relatively famous rather quickly. But it became famous as a psychedelic place, and that's where if certain people touch you, you're never going to be the same. And we had the strobe lights there and the light shows. So it wasn't that easy to convince these artists. And eventually I had to go to Wentzville, Missouri to talk to Chuck directly. I went to Macon, Georgia to talk to Otis Redding to convince him to come out. And when they did come out, the audience was their acceptance. To this day, my fondest memories of this business are watching a predominantly white audience look at Chuck Berry or look at the Staples Singers and look at Albert King or B.B. King or Buddy Guy and Junior Wells. Or we would bring in, we did a show once with The Birds and two one-act plays by Leroy Jones. And just, or another time we did a show with the Russian poet Andrei Voznesensky and Jefferson Airplane, and watching the Russian ladies listen to the poetry and then watching them listening to rock and rolls. It was all new for me and it was all new for them. It was the most exciting time of my life.
As the businessman in the rock world, you were dealing with a lot of groups who were getting high a lot and who were into the counterculture. I'm talking about the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of groups who wanted to turn you on and see what happened?
Yeah.
That actually happened once, didn't it?
It's happened more than once, but it happened one time in particular where it was the only time that I ever knowingly lost it to some extent, just went with it. Yeah.
Is this the Grateful Dead story?
Yeah.
7-Up, was it?
Yeah.
Well, tell us what happened.
They played the Fillmore quite often, and there was always, come on, Bill, let's get happy together. And I had a very strong rule about my work life that during working hours, I was straight, and I expected everybody that worked at the Fillmore to be the same. And I pushed that very strongly because we need to be clean and clear to deal with the public and the artists, and I have no right to tell them what they need to do as long as they were civil and relatively humane. And in those days, I drank a lot of 7-Up, just it was my liquid of that era. And it had gotten to a point where my wife, when I went to work at Dead shows, when they played the Fillmore, would pack my lunch and put it in a bag and put a wax seal on it and take my thermos and just make sure that everything that I had wasn't tampered with, which is true. And I'd break the seal and have my lunch and touch nothing else there, except then some 7-Ups, but nothing else. Wouldn't eat anything there. And this particular evening when they were playing at the place, I walked into their dressing room, and it was just a habit. I would always walk in, go to one of the tubs that we had that was full of 7-Up and Coca-Cola and whatnot, and have a drink. And they knew this, so this particular night, unbeknownst to me, someone who I eventually came to find out who that was, someone had taken a hypodermic needle and stuck it through the cans of 7-Up in this particular bucket, and nobody else touched them. They said, that's the Graham lair. That's where he's going to dip in. And sure enough, I picked up a can of 7-Up, and about a half hour later, I was on my way to Mars. And I felt very good and felt very much at ease and felt very elated and very riding on a carpet. And Mickey Hart in the band asked if
this
I
is
wanted
the drummer from the band, Grateful Dead.
If I wanted to come on stage with the guys, and I said no, I just introduced the band. He said, "Well, we'll only play if you come on stage, and here's a drumstick, and why don't you lead the band, and tell us what songs you want to hear, and whatever that is, we'll just play that, and we'll keep going all night long." Well, that night I conducted this the band from the stage the whole night, and just hit the cymbals, and hit the barbells, and played the cowbell, and it was by far the most uninhibited night of my life.
Were you embarrassed or liberated
Not
the day
at all.
After?
The day after, I just wondered if I had made a total ass of myself. But I didn't think I did, and I didn't remember that I did, and never went beyond the context of doing what they invited me to do. I didn't go beyond that. I didn't try to sing. I didn't try to shout, and I didn't try to dance. I just I know their songs quite well. And just picked some songs, and they played them. It was a joyous event. It really was.
Did it change your life in any way?
No.
No?
No. But I had already become a fan of that scene. Not just the music, but the fact that these people, that the group never used to this day, doesn't use props. They don't wear tight pants. There are no hydraulic lifts. There's no tumbling drum set, and the people come into a space, they're all doves, and they basically come to enjoy themselves and partake in a sort of union And I'm very much in favor of that.
We're listening to a 1989 interview with rock impresario Bill Graham, who died Friday night. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. We return to a 1989 interview with the late Bill Graham.
Now, you closed the Fillmore, East and West, in 1971.
Correct.
What were your reasons?
Sometimes the thing that breaks your back is a slight thing, but there were things leading up to it. I had been having considerable problems having groups continue to play there. Rock and roll became very, very popular in 70, 71, 72. And many of the groups wanted to play in Madison Square Garden or the Cow Palace because they were becoming more successful. And at that time, I was having many problems with managers and agents fighting off this price avalanche that bands said, but we can earn $100,000 up there. I said, well, play there, but also play here. But in early 71, one of the few heroes that I had was a great international impresario of show business named Saul Hurok. And he had called me, and I went to see him, that he had a month's cancellation in April of 71 at the Metropolitan Opera House, that the Stuttgart Ballet had to cancel, and would I be interested in coming in and co-producing a series of events with him there? And I thought it was a great opportunity to even further legitimize rock and roll, and I thought some of the quality bands like the Byrds and the Band and the Mothers of Invention, many of them could go into the Metropolitan Opera House. And I began lining them up, but a particular phone call that I received from a manager of a band who returned my phone call when I said, this is a great opportunity for your group to go into the Metropolitan Opera House. It's a very expensive building, but isn't it great to be able to do that? And he returned my call right after a late show at the Fillmore, and I was sitting in the office around 3 in the morning. And when he said, what's the money? I said, well, for the week, for 6 shows, you can make $50,000, which was still a lot of mm-hmm. money. But in rock and roll terms, it had already become not so high when you realize what you can earn somewhere else. And his exact words to me were, you expect my boys to work for a lousy 50 grand a week? That did it.
So you closed up.
Yeah.
The rock world has become much more corporation-dominated than it's ever been before. You have something of a rock empire yourself, but it's not like the really large corporations, the multinationals who are sponsoring some of the rock mm-hmm. tours. Do you feel that some of your business is being taken away by the corporate sponsors who are underwriting some of the really large rock tours?
Well, not really. For example, here locally, we built an amphitheater and spent most of my savings to build this facility. But the one thing that an opportunity I had was to be we were offered substantial millions of dollars to allow signage, corporate signage, inside the facility. And I have always felt very strongly that when somebody buys a ticket and sits down to look at the stage, that there is nothing, there are no cars being thrown at you, or cigarettes being thrown at you, or soft drinks, that you came to see that artist. To the best of my ability, I've tried very hard not to do that. And I'm rock and roll is part of big business. And I have become part of that, and I can't be that hypocritical. I don't nearly enjoy a show in a stadium as much as I enjoy a show in a theater. And if my saying no would mean that artist would play in a theater, I would do so. But if an artist can earn in one stadium show what it would take him a week to earn in a theater, he invariably makes a decision to play in the stadium, because in the end, it means less time on the road earning a living and more time to partake with the pleasures of having made it. I would just as soon work 5 nights in a theater and earn the same amount of money as I would in 1 night in a stadium.
For the past few years, you've been doing a lot of really big benefits, Live Aid, the Amnesty International tours, a big crack benefit concert in New York, and you've got you're co-producing a series of concerts to concerts against AIDS coming up in San Francisco. How did you get into doing that?
it's not really getting into anything that came from the meme troop days of just being involved with the community. I'm always leery about how to state this because people think, well, he must be covering up something. Is it public relations? Is it an image? It's very simple that we have a certain talent, and I have a certain talent in public assemblage and producing shows. And I live in this community, and I'm concerned about this planet. I don't perform. Any time anyone approaches us regarding a project that I think is valid, if it's to raise money to save the library, send kids to camp, whatever it might be, if it's valid, I then try to explain to you what our services are. You, who come to us with the project, need to have the bands commit. If the bands commit, we will drive the bus. We will sell the tickets. We will get the sound and lights. And we cover our expenses. We never want to make a profit. But that is our strength, so that you can go to an artist and say, we want to save this recreational pool, and will you play? But if they say to you, well, how will you produce the show? You don't know how to do that. We do. So you can say, well, BGP will do that. That is our service, and that's the best way that we can put back, just the way that's the way the Grateful Dead can put back, or the Bruce Springsteen can, or Sting. The way they can put back is by being the power that draws the people there to buy the ticket.
Rock impresario Bill Graham, as recorded in 1989 in San Francisco. Graham died Friday night in a helicopter crash. This is Fresh Air.